And we're live.
Welcome.
Is what I like to say, even though this is completely pre-recorded.
This is your intro. That is, it's your famous intro that you always do.
Famous intro. Welcome, everyone, once again, for the second time, to the Pursuit of Perfectness
Podcast. Or if this is your first time, welcome to your first time to the Pursuit of Perfectness Podcast.
Welcome.
Welcome. The point is, everyone is welcome. All are welcome.
Let me introduce my co-host, Dennis Pacheco. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Dennis Pacheco. And I'm an improviser and actor in New York City. And let me introduce my co-host. You've heard her voice. Yeah, it's Ellen Matthews.
Yay.
Hi, everybody. Ellen Matthews here. Also an improviser in New York City. And we're so excited to be with you once again to talk about perfection. Really, really exciting stuff because today we have our first guest ever.
He's coming up in just a minute.
He's in the holding room
He's
right
in the
now.
Holding tank right now, like a Houdini-esque water tank where he's completely isolated from any sensation. I hear he's very relaxed. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Sensory deprivation tank is where
thank you.
We keep all of our guests so they can't, they don't hear this banter. Okay. They're in deep Zen meditation right now.
Well, and if this is your first time joining us, this is the podcast where we talk about perfectionism or perfectness and the ways that it helps us, the ways it holds us back. And we want to answer that age old question. Can we be perfect? I don't know. Probably not. Maybe we can. Yeah. Let's find out.
Dennis, did you have a perfect week, a stressful week since I last saw you?
Oh my goodness. I had such a couple, these past couple weeks has been very exciting and atypical for me because I went to Orlando for my dad's 70th birthday, which was
Happy
stressful.
Birthday.
Thank you. Which was stressful because it was like a couple's vacation, me and my girlfriend. And we get along. We have a good relationship. But you never know.
You get along with your girlfriend.
Yeah, we like
fantastic.
Each other. We're good. But you never know with vacations how they're going to go because vacations are
oh,
stressful.
It's a big time test.
So
it's a big time test, vacations.
Yeah. So, you know, so I was telling my therapist about it and our couples therapist about it because we do so much therapy.
So you had a pre-therapy session before the couple's vacation. That's wonderful.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And, that's the kind of anal energy that I love. Like, let's get ahead of this. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's write down some fights that may come up.
We did that.
That's amazing. I love that. That is how you gear up for a perfect vacation. You anticipate. I love that.
And folks, it was a good vacation. It was stressful. I don't have to get into that right now, but I came back, slept in my own bed for one night, and then took an Amtrak up to Boston the next night where I was shooting a commercial for a large
big shot over here. Big shot. You heard it here,
company.
Folks.
Not the one you think, but the other one. And... And so I'm real excited for that one to come out. It was super fun. Four nights in Boston. How wild. Came back Labor Day weekend. I mean, it's just vacation on top of vacation on top
wow.
of vacation. Folks, a little peek behind the curtain. Your capsule in time. It is just past Labor Day weekend as we record this. Sorry. I ruined the illusion. How was your week?
Wow.
Alan, do you have a perfect week?
That is hard to top, and I won't even try because you're just killing it. So congratulations.
Thank you. It's
my week,
super atypical.
That's you'll never hear it again. My week was great. Again, spoiler alert, it was Labor Day weekend. The weather in New York was beautiful. I got outside every day in the weekend, which is often a goal of mine. I try to move in some way every day and get outside. So I did get 10,000 steps
mm-hmm.
each day. The perfect amount of steps. And I did some Orange Theory, which is a workout class I do. And accomplished my goals that I set for myself in terms of exercise. So I'm feeling pretty good about myself as well.
All right. Sounds like we're starting the week good.
Starting enough with some real good energy. What do you think? Should we release Greg from sensory deprivation?
Let's undo these big old-fashioned locks.
All right. Well, while you're undoing the locks, I will let our listeners know who they're about to hear from. So, ladies and gentlemen, this man is my brother. First and foremost, that's your first label, is you are Ellen Matthews's brother. Secondly, his name is Greg. He's a dad. He's a husband. He is a professor. He is a statistician. He is an artiste, a Kaggle champion. I don't know what Kaggle is, but I'm sure we'll find out. An open war author. Sounds impressive. And an improviser. And I just want to say, while Greg's is in the tank and can't defend himself, that I am his little sister and I started doing improv first and he copied me and now he does improv.
You're so...
And I just want to set the tone.
You're very angry.
Before striking he comes
that,
out.
Striking that pencil on the desk.
Just say that he's a big fat copycat. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome... the copycat, Greg Matthews.
Yay! Welcome, it's Greg.
It's great to be here with that intro. It's totally true. She did it first. But imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Aww. Aww, that's real sweet. I was expecting something really sarcastic, but how wonderful.
Well, there's plenty of time for the sarcasm.
Excellent. Well, Greg, thank you so much for being our first guest. We're really, really honored. And I feel like you have a very impressive resume. I was showing Dennis your website before this. It's not every day that you see somebody who combines being a statistician and being an artist. That's really unique.
Yeah, some very cool stuff on there.
Well, and I believe deep down that we're all artists. You just need to do it. You know what I mean? Mm. The real answer is in your heart.
That's actually really true. Writers write, painters paint. Right? There's nothing more to it than that.
Yeah. Just go do it.
That's exactly right. I love that.
Simple but hard.
Mm. Yeah, art's one of those things that you don't need to. There's no like. You don't need to pass an exam to be an artist. To be an artist, you just say, hey, I'm going to be an artist, and you just start making stuff. And that's how you become an artist, right? If you want to be like a professor, you have to go and get a degree, and then you have to go through all this, and someone's going to hire you. But like, you can be an artist like just by saying, I'm an artist.
By doing it, you become it. And it doesn't matter if you have any sort of credentials, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think? That's such an interesting point. What do you think? Because on this podcast, we talk about the pursuit of perfectness and the stress that comes with that. To you, what is more stressful? The artist route, right? I'm just going to do it and I am it. Or, you know, trying to get tenure at an institution.
Tenure is way more stressful. The difference is that with art, I can make anything, and if someone doesn't like it, that's totally fine. I get it. It's all subjective. All through school and all through the tenure process, when you're writing all these papers, I'm constantly worried about, you know, did I write something in a paper that is objectively wrong, and someone's going to point it out, and I'm going to be like, oh man, I screwed up big time. Right. There's like right and wrong things to do. And you could write it down. You can make a huge mistake. And I like lose sleep over that. But you also need to sort of a colleague who was a little bit older than me when I was doing my postdoc told me that you don't want to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I've heard that before, but like it really does apply to to writing papers, and it applies to doing art, and it applies to doing comedy and improv. If you are completely paralyzed by waiting until something is absolutely perfect, like with an academic paper, you'll never put the paper out, and you have to put out papers to get tenure, and you have to do art to be an artist. And so you're going to do things that aren't perfect, but it's better to do imperfect things than to not do something until it's perfect. That's deep. Write that down. I think that's good. Dennis, write that down, right?
I'm writing everything you're saying.
I wrote it down.
You actually did write it down.
I literally wrote it down.
She's held up a notebook and she did indeed write it down.
Wow.
It's an audio forum, but we'll explain what's happening to our listeners.
Yeah. Speaking of that, being an artist, I actually went to art school. And I'd always, my whole life, been very, letting the perfect be the enemy of the good and not finishing art things. And I don't know, I think somehow I figured that if I went to art school that I'd have permission to be able to finish things, or I'd learn how to finish things. But it never really worked out. So I'm not really a visual artist anymore. I found a new dream. So don't weep for me, listener.
So Dennis, let me ask you this. So I think my wife went to art school. Uh-huh. And I know a bunch of people who went to art school, and I didn't know you went to art school, but you did. And you're sort of saying this kind of thing that I've heard from people who go to art school a lot, is that or they're sort of shackled by the ideas of, art orthodoxy, where this is art, and if you're not doing this kind of art, you're not really an artist. I am completely untethered to anything that would tie an artist down. I have no formal training. I can't do anything. My entire foray into the art world has been completely getting educated from my wife just telling me things and then going and doing it. And I think that really helps me, because I have no sense of how good or bad I am. I just enjoy doing it. But when you go to art school, you like sort of understand what's good and bad. And I think if you do something, you're maybe too hard on yourself when you, because you know what's bad. I just do stuff and like, I think it's fun, and it's probably terrible according to like traditional art schools, but I'm not going to stop doing it. I like it too much.
Well, and that's great. And that's the problem with, that's the problem with a lot of the art school culture, I think, is like the judgmental, miasma or whatever around you. It's like, there's some teachers who are totally cool and encouraging, and then there's some teachers who are like, no, wrong, bad, do it this way, you're doing it wrong, and make students cry. And I can think of at least make students cry, and I can think of at least one professor that made someone cry in my class. It wasn't me, I'm thinking back and I'm like, untrained art, that we did have this snooty sort of nose in the air kind of thing, even though I went in the least snooty area possible, which is cartooning or comics, which is like the most like working man's it's the mess of the art world.
The mess of the art world.
Yeah, and that's a good reference, because I know sports, and that's a great reference. But yeah, like people who didn't go to art school, we called them, you'd call them like outsider artists, and the image of that is like somebody, who has like a pipe fell on their head and they have severe brain damage, and they make their Ken and Barbie dolls fight each other in war.
Dennis, I have an ex-girlfriend from high school who I still talk to, and we still talk fairly regularly. And I started making art maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And one of the first things she said about it was, "This reminds me of outsider art." And I was like, "Come on, man." And so like, when you look up outsider art, it's like people with like brain injuries making art.
Yeah, that's the connotation, and it's so unfair. Not that there's anything wrong with having brain injuries. You can't help it if you got a fucking brain injury, But
I have never heard of this. Outsider art is art done by people with brain injuries?
It's done by people who are not formally trained.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. We were talking about brain injuries, were we
That's
not?
That's true. Well, I'm thinking of a really specific guy they made a movie out of, a documentary.
You're talking about Marlon Call, aren't you?
Yeah. But anyway, but like, you know, you think somebody who's like lives in the Ozarks and, you know, and went to all the way to second grade and, you know, and draws with like, you know, I don't know, squirrel guts or something, you know, it's like that's the implication of outsider art. You know what I mean? When really it's just like somebody who didn't pay a bunch of money to have people tell them they're doing it wrong. You know what I mean?
That, you know, this is really interesting, and I wonder if I wrote down, because I'm writing down a lot, guys.
Yeah.
I wrote down the word identity, and I wonder if you remove the act from your identity, if that's what takes the pressure off. So, like, Greg, if you say you're so removed from it, right? So if you make a piece of art and it doesn't do well, right, with an audience, you could be like, well, I'm not an artist, what do you expect, right? You can kind of remove yourself. Whereas Dennis, like, you're like, no, I actually paid to go to school to, you know, like, it is me. If I don't put out a good product, what does this say about who I am and how I have invested my energy?
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's where the stress comes from, this identity.
I think that's so true. Once you make it your identity, then it's like it's 100 times more pressure.
Yeah. I mean, I have to put a lot more thought and effort into, you know, if I'm doing a statistical analysis or I'm writing a paper, that's so much more of my like real identity. It's like it's a profession, right? And it's very different when something is your profession versus a hobby or a side hustle. That's what the kids say, right, Alan?
That's right. I've just confirmed that is what the kids are saying.
Yeah.
Side hustle.
You just watched the TikTok about it?
I just watched 3 TikToks.
It's like
on super speed.
It's like there's no downside to this. There's no risk involved in it for me, right? With art or I mean the same thing with improv or stand up or music or any of those things. If I make terrible art of any kind, there's no consequence for me. I like doing it, and there's no consequence. If I start, you know, screwing up statistics, you know, there's real life consequences for me. I don't even know what that would mean, just screwing up statistics. But
it's never been done. Greg Matthews says ruined statistics. But I mean, you could like maybe publish a paper that was wrong, and you know, a bunch of peers that edit your papers, I assume that's how academia works, submitted papers rebutting everything you said, and then your reputation was ruined.
So well, can I ask you this, Greg?
Yeah. That's how academia works, right? Okay, cool.
I mean, it sounds right to me. And I'm the one who is the final arbiter of academia, right, in this room?
That's right. That's right. Dennis just checked 3 TikToks, and that is...
There's definitely an academia TikTok. I mean,
there is.
But yeah, so what I was going to ask you, Greg, is when you say like screwing up, do you mean like just get the data wrong? Is it a data thing or is it like your conclusions? Can you maybe just walk us through how the creation of a paper goes from, you know, for those of us who aren't in that field?
You really want to talk about statistics? I'm happy to talk about it.
Statistics. I'm a big fan.
So, there's sort of 2 different tracks of types of papers that a statistician would write, and one of those would be like a methodological paper or a theoretical paper where you're developing some new type of statistical technique or method, and then there's applied papers. I am about as far onto the applied side as you can get. I work with people. I'm working on developing methods with people, but there's no way I could do this stuff on my own. But I have collaborators who are much more methodological than I am. So like if I'm writing an applied paper, we would get, you know, we would get a data set, we would have a research question, and we would try to go about answering that question. So let me give you an example of the most recent paper I've published was about, I don't know if you're familiar with the – Dennis likes sports, right? The Houston Astros. Sports. The Houston Astros were accused of
cheating. That book Moneyball was about the Astros, right?
Moneyball is about the Oakland A's.
Doesn't A stand for Astros?
Yeah. Yes, Dennis. Yes.
No, it stands for athletics. I know this.
It's for athletics.
I'm a sportsman. Yeah.
So the Astros were accused of cheating a few years ago by banging on a trash can.
They would bang
on a trash can to steal the sign from the pitcher, and they knew a pitch was coming. And so the question that we wanted to answer was how much of a benefit was this to hitters, and can we measure it? Can we quantify what that was?
Oh, wow.
And so you need to go and get a data set that can help you answer that question. Then you need to choose methods that are appropriate. Then you need to clean the data. You need to run the analysis, and you're making all these assumptions along the way. And then you have conclusions, and your conclusions need to be supported by your analysis. And so now there's a million places in this process where you can screw up. And I've come to be able to live with this, but like, I'm sure if we went back and did it again, we'd find places where we made mistakes, probably not big mistakes, but there's just so many places to make a mistake.
Of course.
And this could be, maybe we included some data that shouldn't have been included, or something was excluded, or a modeling assumption was violated, or, you know, one of the critiques we got from this was that we weren't controlling for multiple hypothesis testing, though I think I have a justification for why that specific thing didn't apply here. But there's all these – people are going to critique you all the time in academics. Everything you write, people are going to critique. I probably don't write stuff that people care about enough to actually pick over it with a fine-tooth comb. But it's out there, and people are going to read it. And, you know, if someone really wanted to look hard enough, they could probably find mistakes in most of the stuff that anyone has written, right? There's just so many places to make mistakes that if you look hard enough, you can probably find them. They're probably not gigantic mistakes, but nothing you're ever going to do is perfect.
So that remains to be seen, but so what's the answer? Was it a benefit? How big of a benefit?
So we found that there was three basic models that we looked at. One was, are they swinging less when they know the sign? And so they were swinging less when they knew it was going to be an off-speed pitch, which would mean that it was outside of the zone more often. So they were swinging less at pitches when they knew they were going to be off-speed pitches, like curveballs or changeups or things like that. When they did decide to swing, they were missing less often when they knew what the sign of the pitch was. And then when they made contact with the ball, the exit velocity we found was significantly high. It was slightly significantly higher for off-speed pitches. When they knew it was an off-speed pitch, it was actually an off-speed pitch. They swung and made contact. We saw about a 2.5 mile per hour increase in exit velocity, which is about, I think it was about 15 feet, which is the difference between a home run and a warning track hit in kind of a lot of situations.
So the answer is, yeah.
The answer is
it does.
Definitely. The answer is we're careful. We have to be careful here. We can't say that it helped them win games. We're not willing to say that yet because statisticians are very cagey people. But we are saying that they definitely, there's evidence that they changed their on-field behavior based on knowing the sign of the pitch. And in all likelihood, it did help them in their performance in games, but we're just willing to say that it affected on-field behavior in ways that were positive to the Astros. Mm. But we can't say things like, well, they added 2 wins because of this. We're not willing to make a statement about that quantity.
Such a scientist.
I'm thinking the same thing. My head is spinning. That's really fascinating. I didn't know. I don't think I knew about your papers before. That's really interesting.
Well, that's because you don't care.
We care. Ellen cares.
We care. That's why you're on the podcast.
Well, you weren't like, let's get Greg on the podcast so we can talk about statistics.
No, we just want to talk about stuff that stresses you out. And I'm learning a ton. I'm learning either to make things less stressful, don't associate it with your identity, right? Because if it's not part of your identity, that's the best space to create, right? There's no pressure at all. Mm. Or if it is part of your identity, make sure it's so niche and fringe that nobody is going to take the time or energy to critique you. So I learned two very important things when it comes to pursuing perfection.
Yeah.
I guess those are lessons somehow.
Well, can we, Ellen, I don't know if you wanted to talk about comedy, but I did want to talk about the art part of the making art with statistics. Do you want to, can we
please
get into
go
that?
Ahead? Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, so tell us a little bit about some of the art that you've made using statistics, and describe it with words. Because if you show pictures, people won't see them because it's a podcast.
Yeah, that's true. You've nailed the medium. You've adequately described the medium that you're working in.
Thank you.
So I started making art probably like actually like really trying to do it, and I think it was 2014. So it's been like eight years, something like that. And what I was first doing, I would consider to be generative art, where I was writing scripts in this programming language R, which is what I use to do actual statistics. And I realized that you can write code to generate generate art. So I'm not like, I didn't like invent this. This is like there's plenty of people who are generative artists where they write, or sometimes they'll call themselves code artists, where they will write code, and then if you let the code run with different starting points, it'll be the same code, but you get different output. And so I was really interested in generative art, and I'm still interested in generative art. And so I was doing things like visualizing games of chance and letting those games of chance sort of dictate what the visualization would look like. So I'm looking at my wall right now. Just on my wall in my office, I have roulette, dominoes, Powerball, and craps. And they are they're visualizations of those games. And what I really like to try to do is I like to make something. I sort of got this idea from my wife. Everything I know about art is from my wife. I like to try to make things that visually look appealing by themselves, and then when you understand the process that was used to create them, you like it even more. That's my goal with everything that I try to make. So this one on this was, you know, back in my I would say this is the first phase of my art career. Mm-hmm. You know, when my retrospective at the Whitney eventually happens, this would be the early phase of my career. And what I've moved more towards now is what I would consider truly data art, where I'm using data as a foundation for the visualizations. So I'm looking at my other stuff on my wall. Google is tracking you constantly. I have an Android phone, and they're just constantly tracking you. I mean, not just Google. Apple is doing this too if you have an iPhone. And you can actually go and get this data. And I was using my Android tracking data as a source of visualization. And you can create like snapshots of what a day in your life looked like, right? And so this asks really interesting questions about you know, are we okay with being tracked like this? And, you know, you can create these awesome visualizations, but they should also raise a question in a viewer's mind, you know, oh my God, my phone's tracking me. Like, I don't think we think about this enough, about everything that's tracking us.
Actually,
it's like beautiful and scary.
Yeah.
It's beautiful and scary at the same time. You look at it and you're in awe and also in fear.
Yeah. There's a fine line between customer service and wild invasion of privacy.
My Maps app will sometimes be like, let's look at your past month and everywhere you've been. And I'll be like, why are you showing me this? Keep this to yourself.
Yeah.
I don't want to know that you're trying. Like, track me, but don't tell me about it. I don't know. That feels worse somehow. But it asked me about restaurants that I haven't been to, but just because I was in the same building. It's like, how is Sweetgreen? Like, I don't. But can you actually turn your camera so we can see some of the art that you're?
And for the listeners, I will say that you can see Greg's art at statsinthewild.com. So check out his website.
Backslash art. That's so much more organic than I thought it would be.
Well, so this is from the Google Image Search series. There's a series of these. This is good podcasting, you guys. Really crushing it.
Look on the website, listeners.
Yeah, and for our Patreon, which we don't have, you'll see the video, which we and don't. You won't.
Here's one of my favorite. This is from the Google Image Search series. This one is lips. I really like this one. I don't know if you can see it
with the reflection. It's kind of hard to see, but
yeah. It'd probably be better if you just brought them up on your computer. It's all up there on the computer.
Yeah, you can search these.
This whole wall is also other stuff.
Search for these. They're great. Very cool.
That's really nice.
And then I have these.
I said they're all in your office too.
These are works by someone else named Tom White. He's from New Zealand. There's a rabbit, and there's a banana, and there's a baseball, and these are all. This is way cooler than anything I've ever done. I think he was generating. He was taking a training data set, and he would train he would take a bunch of rabbits, and he would train a model to identify what a rabbit was, and then he is generating. At least this is my understanding of it. He was generating an image that would fool a classifier, and it'll be like you can show that image. So you can show that image to a classifier, and it'll be like, oh, that's a rabbit. And then this one, you can, oh, that's a banana. And so it's like these are objects that he's creating that, according to the computer, that's a banana and that's a rabbit. And then what he does is he screen prints them. These are two color screen prints. And I think they're fantastic.
And just so the listener knows, these things do not look like a banana or a rabbit. They look like if the banana and the rabbit got into that teleportation machine from Cronenberg's Fly movie. That's what they look like. And the computer's
such a good reference.
This is a rabbit. And you're just like, kill it with fire.
It's such a human thing to say. Computers know this is a rabbit.
Yeah.
You just can't tell because you're not a computer.
Yeah.
Classic mistake.
It's true. Look, computers can't be wrong. We know this. They're the most perfect.
Greg, are there very, very many other data artists that you have found? Is it like a, vibrant community?
So there are people who are professional, full-time data artists.
That's not good because then it's part of their identity.
Exactly. Yeah, but they're stressed out about it because they got to pay the bills. I think a lot of the data artists got rich doing something else and now they're data artists because they have.
Okay.
I don't know for sure, but is anyone really an artist
for money? Get rich and then
that's like the unspoken like. Career path for artists is like do something else that gets you rich.
So there's a woman named Lori Frick. Look her up sometime. She's a data artist. She does some really interesting work. That's why I would say Lori Frick, Tom White. Those are the two I would start with.
She's writing this down. Writing it.
I'm writing it down.
Makes great podcasting.
Oh my gosh. I love this. This is fascinating stuff. I love that we dove so far into statistics, so far into art. I still feel like there's so much to cover. I want to talk about how you stress out over comedy, how to stress out over raising kids. That seems really stressful and something that I feel like I would try to be perfect in. For people, to update everybody, Greg, you've been doing, some virtual stand-ups, sets lately. Is that right?
So I've done improv for, I think, 6 years now, which is Ellen wants me to state on the record that is less time than she has been doing improv for. So she is better. She's a better improviser than I am. She's been doing it longer. That's all I have to say. I'm legally obligated to say that. And I've always wanted to try stand up and I've always sort of been able to say, well, I'll try it later. And then the pandemic happened and there was nothing to do. And, I was just following some people on Facebook who, you know, they were like, oh, we're doing some virtual open mics. And I had so little idea when I started about how to do it. I was like, wait, so I can just show up and do an open mic? And they were like, yeah, that's what an open mic is. And I'm like, so I don't need to get booked, or you don't need to like let me on the open mic. They're like, no, it's an open mic. And so I was floored that this even existed. I was like, wait, so I can just show up and say whatever I want for 5 minutes?
You're like acting like it's tenor. You're like, I don't need to submit before a board and have them like review me.
It blew my mind. So yeah. There was this virtual mic on Sunday nights called Fun Simulation. So what's really interesting about this mic is that they were in person for years, and they were called Fun Simulation 2000. And then I never did it in person, and then they went online, and it was called Fun Simulation 2000. And so I was like, oh, it's called Fun Simulation 2000 because it's a simulation of
stand-up.
And then I was like, oh, wait, no, it's been running. It was running for 6 or 7 years before this. It was just what it was called. And so I started doing that, and I did that every Sunday night starting last October. And I basically did that every Sunday night for until May. Now there's like live mics in Chicago again. I did one mic over and over and over again. And I sort of got comfortable with that. And then I was like, I got to try other mics. And so then I've been branching out, and I did more virtual mics. And, as of right now, I have done four in-person open mics. So that's nice. Where we stand. I've probably done 50 virtual mics and 4 in-person open mics. That is the extent of my comedy career.
And would you say being live is much better?
It's a totally, totally different thing. I mean, it's obviously it's totally different.
Yeah.
It doesn't even compare. I learned more doing the 4 in-person mics than you could learn doing virtual mics for years, I think.
Because you have the immediate feedback of the audience, the laughing. Or not laughing.
When you're
the energy, you can feel the energy too, right?
Yes. When you're doing a virtual mic, everyone shuts off their mics, and you have no idea who's laughing or not, right? I mean, some good mics they'll be like, everyone's got to have their mic on and you laugh, but like most of the time people are like not paying attention or whatever. And so it's basically me just telling jokes into a void. And then there's someone listening to say, you have a minute left.
That's
right.
That's such a weird way to start your stand-up career. It's like that's in a room that's like like a featureless room with white walls and begin.
You know, it's interesting because I feel like with other kinds of art, you know, like putting out a piece, right, a painting or one of your data art pieces, it's kind of like you put it out there and you don't really need to know the feedback, right? Like it's out there and that itself is the accomplishment. But with something like stand up, you need the feedback immediately. You need it right away. That's part of it. As opposed to like, this is my piece and I'm good with this piece. It's like the presentation is also a solicitation, right?
Wow, that's deep.
I'm going to write that down. The presentation is the solicitation.
That's deep. So like with art, if I'm making a piece, I just did these little stupid pixel presidents that I'm trying to sell as NFTs. And I messed around with that for, you know, 2 weeks, but no one will ever see the stuff that I did that I didn't like. No one's ever going to see that. In stand-up, by its very nature, anything that makes it to a final product, someone had to see it, and that's the successful stuff. Everything else that you try is you try it and you have to fail in front of people. And it is I feel like I can't – my experience is so limited that I don't really feel like I can speak as a comedian, but I can speak as someone who has done – 50 Zoom open mics and 4 open mics.
Perfect.
I have a lot of thoughts about it. It is psychologically, if I had done this when I was 20, 25, I would have done one open mic and quit.
Interesting.
as someone who's, I am nearly 40. I have 3 kids. I have tenure. I'm married. I'm pretty comfortable with who I am and where I'm at. And there's no, like, failing is fine. It doesn't matter. Because I've been, right. I'm relatively successful in so many other areas. I'm so happy. I'm happy with where I am. So what does it matter if I fail? You know, it doesn't, like,
yeah.
If I go and do an open mic and no one laughs at all, it's fine. I have one of the things I my opening joke is, I don't care how this goes. I'm out of the house. I'm away from the kids. So it's all a win for me anyway, right? And but like that's not really a joke. It's sort of right. Like this is a thing I like. Well. I do. I love my kids. I love my wife and I love my kids. I know that's not a cool thing to say, but I do. I do love them. But like,
you love your wife.
Okay. I'm working. Ellen, I'm going to ask you about this. I got a joke that it's not quite right. And you know, I'm going to email you about this because I can't figure it out. But the premise of the joke is something about how I got to say something. That's not too cool. I know it makes me kind of, maybe it makes me a little bit of a bitch, but I love my wife and kids. I know I'm a simp. I'm a cuck. So, I don't know, something like that.
It's good. It's got legs.
There's something there. But failing is it's fine. Like I'm totally fine with it. And it's also it's two things. I'm old enough to be fine with it and it's also not my identity.
There you go.
Right? It's the same thing. Like I don't I say on Facebook, I'm a stand-up comedian and tenure is my side hustle, but like obviously that's not true.
It's amazing.
And so I don't,
you know what?
My identity's not a comic.
You know what I do though, Greg and Dennis? I shift my identity to make this work. So if I'm doing improv and I have a bad show or a bad scene, I'm like, well, I have a day job, you know, like this isn't my thing. But then at my day job, if I do poorly, I'm like, yeah, well, improv's my passion. So like I just shift my identity to whatever works for me. And I honestly do
that's
this.
Healthy,
and it makes me feel better because I think the more kind of identities you can have, it's like you don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? Like I'm many different things. So I don't have to be perfect at any one thing.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I'm more in the camp of like, well, that could have, like, if I have a show that I feel like, it could have gone better, I'm just going to think about it now.
I'm just going to brood over it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing that helps me get over it is like, well, next time it'll be better. But the other thing that helps me get over it is people being like, that was good. Shut up.
The thing with improv too, I think, is that, and I have much more experience with this, and I've been with one group for the whole time. I've only ever performed with, well, that's not true, but for 6 years, it's almost entirely been one group. It's the same people over and over and over again. And everyone will have better or worse shows, but like, we never collectively have shows that are awful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In stand-up, I'm awful. I'm awful at it, right? Like I'm awful at it. I'm aware of this, and I'm aware that it's all my fault. I can't blame anyone else, and I still go, I'm gonna keep going and doing this because I like it.
Yeah,
it's also weird because I should be writing things that the audience will think is funny because that's how you're supposed to be. That's how you're successful, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
I am very much not doing the right thing. I am writing things that I think are funny. And,
yes.
And when like the audience doesn't laugh, I go, I don't care. I think that's funny. Screw you guys.
Well,
which is why I'll never be a successful comedian, and it's okay.
Well, but you said the things that come back are the things that work, right? Didn't you say that? Or did I just pick that? Did I just put words in your mouth?
No, I mean, that's right too. I'm being a little bit, I'm being a little bit sarcastic where, I do care. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm not, when I write, I'm not writing things that I think the audience will think this is funny.
Yeah.
I'm writing things that I think are funny and then keeping the things that I think are funny and also the audience thinks are funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. It's gotta be both.
I'm not sitting down and going, all right, will someone think this is funny? Like if I don't think it's funny, I just don't, I wouldn't do it. Even if everyone in the world would think it's funny, I still wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
My favorite thing is Greg will pretty frequently send me a text being like, I'm working on this joke and we'll talk about it. And I'll be like, I don't think this is funny. And then Greg will explain to me why it is funny. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Greg, do you see what's happening? Like, if you're not going to explain this into me. Like, if I'm not laughing, if it's not coming out of me, it's not like, oh, you know, like, that's my favorite. When you're like, no, you don't. Let me sit down. Let me explain to you why you will think this is funny. It's the best.
Yeah, just review it so that you can experience the surprise.
There is something really nice about when you're watching someone on stage and you can tell that they think it's really funny. Mm-hmm. Like that in itself is super funny and such a joy to watch. Like when you're like, that person genuinely thinks what they said is funny.
You know what that reminds me of? And I don't know why, but that reminds me of a stand up I saw one time live. And they were crushing. I think they were pretty well known stand up. I don't remember who it was, but they were crushing the whole time. And they got to their, maybe I saw this on TV. I don't know if I saw it live, but that doesn't matter. But they got, it might have been on one of those like Comedy Central, like,
was this a dream?
I think it was on one of those Comedy Central shows they used to show that was just clips of stand up back in the day.
Yeah.
But they were like crushing the whole time, and then they got to their closer, their big closer, and they tossed off their closer, and it didn't work. It didn't work, and they were like, whoa. They like literally went, oh. And then they had to keep going. And I think it was like in that moment, they just went on autopilot, and they were like, this always works. And they just said it, but they weren't in the, in the room present making that moment like work.
Like,
you know what I mean?
With the delivery, they kind of just like phoned it in.
Yeah, they like phoned it in, and the audience just wasn't on board. They're just like, what? And then they were like,
because he wasn't into it, right? Like, he wasn't. She. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, work on internal bias.
Cancel Ellen.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I understand that because. You want to see people doing things that they're passionate about, and that brings them joy.
Yeah, I think my point was, like, in that moment, that comedian didn't think that joke was funny. They thought everyone else thought it was funny.
Oh.
Ooh, yes. Yes. That's deep. I love that.
Nod.
Ugh.
Can we stew on that?
Let's take a minute to stew. Yeah. And just a quick time check. We're 47 minutes in.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to start wrapping up?
We're going to start wrapping up because we don't want this to
before
be...
Before we go, I want to tell you about the four stand-up, the four in-person mics I've done.
Yes, please.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because this is, it's been a journey. It's been a journey, Dennis and Alan.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. So the four open mics I've done, so... Fun Simulation was all online. It was the one I was doing on Sunday night. I have like people I'm friends with through this mic. None of them respect me as a comic, but they are nice to me. They are nice to me because I will go to their shows and they think I mean well. So I figured the first time I ever did stand up open, I ever did a real in-person mic had to be at this Fun Simulation. It's at a bar called Reed's. It's run by this guy named Mark. Mark is spectacular. He's been doing it for years and years and years. I got all dressed up. There's pictures of it. It's the only pictures of me doing in-person stand-up. It's my Facebook profile now.
Cool.
And so I had like what I was going to do, and I like sort of memorized it, but I'd never done it before. And I didn't know if like, can you like, do you like bring a pad of paper and read or how much can I check? And so what I was like, well, I want to try to do it. I want to try to do it without any notes. So I like tried to memorize it. And I went and did it, and I was very satisfied for the first time I ever did an open mic. No one laughed, but it was like in a bar. Someone got a chuckle out of a joke about like about Dungeons and Dragons, and I was like, all right, I went and did it. You got to get this first one out of the way.
Yeah.
I went back the next week. This is on Sunday night. I went back the next week, and I like did not prepare as much as I should have. I had some stuff. I had some ideas, but they weren't like written out, and I didn't know what the wording was. And I went up, and it's hard to say I bombed because I'm just not good at it yet. There's no bombing when you're not good at it, right? You have to be, so I'm just like learning how to do this.
Yeah.
But it was awful. Yeah. And it's recorded, and I like couldn't even listen back to it. And this is at like, I don't know, Ellen, I don't know if you were following me on Facebook, but this is right around the time where I was like, I was sitting at this open mic watching, and I couldn't even concentrate because I was like, I'm uncomfortable in this seat. I was like over 200 pounds. I had been drinking the whole like pandemic. I was super out of shape. And I was like, I got to change something. I wasn't even thinking about comedy. I was like, I got to change my life.
You have an identity crisis.
And so what came out of that was, well, since then I've lost like 15 pounds.
Congrats.
Congratulations. I've stopped
drinking alcohol. And
all together?
I've had 3 drinks since May.
Wow.
I thought you were going to say since noon.
I'm hammered right now. I've had 3 drinks since May, but all 3 of them were before this mic. They're before this podcast. So
wow, that's great. Good for you.
So yeah, I feel great. So but after that, like that was like I don't care if it's not funny ever. I don't care if I ever never tell a funny joke again, but I need to be prepared.
Yeah.
I love that. I need to be
prepared and to at least baseline have things memorized. And so what I decided to do that, like after that, I like didn't do another open mic for a few weeks. And I totally changed the way I was writing things. And I was like looking to see what other people do and what other, it's really fascinating for me to watch the process of other people who are actual comedians. And there are so many people who do the same open mics that I'm doing. I mean, this is Chicago, they're open mics. These people are like booking gigs at real comedy clubs in Chicago. And I get to like go and watch them. And I think this is fascinating. And what I noticed that they're doing is they're not trying to write new material every week. And this is like so obvious that people have been doing comedy doing stand up for like more than 6 months. But I was like, oh, they are really working on the same jokes over and over and over again. And so they'll go up and every week at the same open mic, they will do 90% of the same material and they might try one new thing. They are practicing their jokes for, I mean, you guys are like, that's so obvious, Greg. This was not obvious to me. So what I was like, I'm going to find one thing. I'm going to write about that one thing. And I'm going to do 5 minutes on it, and I'm going to memorize it. I'm going to do it over and over again. So I went, there's a virtual mic on Wednesdays, and I did this one thing over and over and over again for like 4 or 5 weeks at this mic virtually. And then I went and did it in person, but now I had done it so many times that I did it in person at a different mic, which is just down the street from me at a bar called Pressure. And I got strangers to laugh.
Oh,
snap.
Wild. And awesome. It wasn't all the time, but it also wasn't zero. This is recorded.
Hey, you're on an upward trajectory. That's where you want
to
be. Yeah.
To bring this home to the theme of this podcast, you know what they laughed at the most?
What?
They laughed at the parts where I made mistakes.
And acknowledged them? And you were like in the moment?
And I was totally in the moment. I forgot something. I have this part where I go, bitch, please. And then I say, you wouldn't tell LeBron James that you know what it's like to play in the NBA finals because you played an intramural semifinal basketball game in your one semester of community college. So what I said was, bitch, please. And then I forgot what the next part was. And I go, hold on. I forgot what I was going to say. and that's like super funny. I didn't mean it at all.
I love that. I feel like
it is funny.
I love when I feel like the stand-up respects me enough to be like, you know what stand-up is. You know the process. You know what we're doing here. You know, I love that.
I also love just like the confidence of like, bitch, please. And then just the vulnerability of, I have no idea what I was about to say after this. I've completely lost my script.
Oh, so man. Like, that's so funny.
I got to try to find a way. This is one of those things that like, I didn't think was funny, but the audience does. And now I'm like, maybe I should keep that somehow. Like try to write that into it. And this never would have occurred to me on a virtual mic, or I would never write something like that. But like, like doing it.
Yeah.
It was just so different.
You better do a really good job making it look authentic if you're going to like pretend to lose track. You know what I mean? Like people can smell that.
I mean, the lesson is like be present always.
Yeah. I mean, I probably wouldn't actually try to do that on purpose, it's something to think about now. I never would have thought that was funny. So then I did that one on a Tuesday. I did another open mic on a Thursday. And I think I did like better, with my delivery, but it was a different kind of room and like very few people laughed, but I felt way more comfortable with it. And then this was like maybe 6 weeks ago. I haven't done one in the last 6 weeks because these kids are an absolute nightmare. Every night one of them is not sleeping, and I can't just be like, sorry, Sarah, I'm going to do an open mic while you're putting three kids down and they're all screaming. There was a period of time where they were like going down to bed easily enough that I could leave. Now it'll eventually come back, but like it's been a bad like 6 or 8 weeks.
Yeah. Well, you should just explain to them while they're, you know, not going to bed, like, Dad needs to go to stand up, so you need to go to sleep. I mean, you can reason with a 3-year-old, right?
You have no idea. So
they're so cute, Ellen, though.
Dennis, do you have children?
No.
So Ellen's completely wrong about this. She's joking about it, but it's like not even you. Like any attempted reasoning with a 3-year-old is impossible. Like it's just impossible. And but by the way, Ellen, have you ever met Colin in person? Yes, you did. You met him this past summer. All right.
Yes.
We had a pandemic
for the first time.
Yeah, we had a pandemic baby.
Oh wow.
And so that's weird. That's a weird experience. Is you have a kid, no one meets it, and then all of a sudden we show up with a 1-year-old.
Yeah.
At the family gathering. And they're like, where did this kid come? Oh, we had a pandemic baby.
Where'd this guy come from?
We missed the whole newborn baby stage.
You're outside smoking with some like young dude. Who are you again? I was born during the pandemic.
It's my nephew. Can I buy you a drink? Okay. This was amazing. Greg, you were a fantastic guest.
Thank you so much for being our first guest and being so open about your work and your life.
Well, thank you for having me on. I hope when Mom listens to this that she will enjoy it greatly. And Dennis, if your mother listens to it, I hope she also enjoys it greatly.
Thank you.
But our mom will definitely listen to this, like the whole way through, several times probably.
Several times, absolutely. Wow.
Biggest fan of the Matthews kids.
I cannot wait.
Man, love to have a guaranteed audience. That's amazing. And she's great. What a wonderful lady.
I know, she's one of us. She's our improv biggest fan.
Yeah,
too,
she watches our shows.
She watches all of our shows. Betty is a good one. Greg, anything you want to plug before we hop off?
You want me to just plug stuff again? Follow my art at www.statsinthewild.com/art.
Love it.
You can follow me on Twitter at statsinthewild. You can follow me on Instagram at statsinthewild. I'm currently on another Facebook lockdown, so you can't follow me on Facebook because I'm kicked out again.
Greg gets kicked off Facebook like once a month.
We didn't talk about this at all.
I know. We'll have to have you come back and talk about your Facebook bills.
I called an anti-masker a piece of trash.
Okay.
And that got me a 30-day suspension.
that's easy enough to follow.
I can extrapolate.
Yeah.
Well,
You should follow my improv groups. Do I have to say they're a troupe? Are they a troupe? Do we have to
be
a troupe?
You can call them whatever you want.
Follow the Emeralds of Saigon on Facebook. That's our. We haven't done a show since the pandemic, but we are going to be. We're going to be doing some shows hopefully this fall, winter, and into the next spring. And you know what?
Amazing.
You know what? You know what would be awesome? It'd be awesome if Ellen Matthews and Dennis, who doesn't have a last name, you should come to Chicago and do a show with us.
Come to Chicago. I love Chicago.
We would love that.
That sounds amazing.
We would love that.
All right,
that.
Special guest.
We're going to have our booker book that in.
Yeah, your booker?
Our booker. Amazing. Dennis, anything you want to plug before we hop off?
You know what? Come to the Magnet Theater Saturday nights and watch the Armando Diaz Experience. Yeah, you'll have a good time. Ellen, anything you want to plug?
Love it. Magnet Theater, doing shows on the weekends, not during the weekdays right now, because we do classes during
classes. Take a class.
Take MagnetTheater.com. Magnet Theater. Amazing. All right. Well, this was so wonderful. I think we're a little bit closer to perfection than we were when we started this podcast.
Yeah, I think leaning towards we can be perfect beings with no flaws.
Yeah, it is definitely a possibility.
Yeah.
And it's not about balance and just letting things happen. It's about definitely finding a way to be perfect. Is, I think, the takeaway. Great. Let's play out our awesome music.
All right. Bye, everybody. See you next time.
Bye.
Subscribe.